He spent his childhood weeding soybean fields and waking before dawn to detassel corn. This hour, U.S. Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday evening, Republican Senator Ben Sasse spoke at the University of Iowa. In the first half hour today, excerpts from his talk on U.S. foreign policy. Then in the second half hour, he answers my questions and questions from the audience about a number of items in our news, the hyperpartisan climate and that wave of package bombs, transgender identity, the Kavanaugh confirmation, and the role of the Supreme Court, among other issues. Senator Ben Sasse, first this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday evening, Republican Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska spoke at the University of Iowa. Later in the hour, he answers my questions and questions from the audience about a number of items in our news, the hyperpartisan climate and the wave of package bombs, transgender identity, and the Kavanaugh confirmation, and the role of the U.S. Supreme Court, among other issues. But first, let's hear excerpts from his talk on U.S. foreign policy. Senator Sasse started his talk by saying his speech was not going to be about the president, but that there are two things he has been right about.
I think that President Trump is actually far more right than national foreign policy establishment elites tend to get about the fact that we need a fundamental conversation about what the purpose of U.S. foreign policy is. We're talking about sending our sons and daughters into harm's way, and we're talking about taxing Iowans and Nebraskans and folks across another 48 states for the purposes of U.S. foreign policy leadership around the globe. We currently have men and women in uniform stationed in 150 of the world's 200 countries. And the people, all of us, coast, plains, rich and poor, Democrat and Republican, the people need to have some shared sense of what our foreign policy is. And one of the virtues, I think, of President Trump's disruptive campaign in 2015-16 is he's sort of forced us to rethink and re-ask some fundamental questions. So one thing I'll say is that I think the president is more right than foreign policy establishment elites about the need to re-ask fundamental questions. The second thing I think I'll say is that the party that I'm a part of is far, far more wrong than it thinks about the fact that diagnosis isn't enough. Acknowledging that we need disruption of our conversation to sort of rethink and reshare fundamental principles about what the U.S. role in the world is, that's an important truth, but it's insufficient to say we've been sort of rudderless for a couple of decades on the global stage and therefore think you can stop at that without having to get to an actual plan. And I think I'm in a party right now that doesn't have much of an actual plan. I could also criticize Democrats for not having much of an actual plan, but I'm willing to do this self-reflection of saying the party I'm a part of hasn't done a lot to say, once we move from disruption to construction, what do we plan to do and what do we plan to offer the American people? So here's my main thesis. My main thesis is that U.S. global leadership is absolutely essential on the global stage because when the U.S. refuses to lead, inevitably chaos and conflict follow, and when all hell breaks loose, hell tends to boomerang back home. U.S. leadership on the global stage is essential and indisputable. To say that there's an isolationist opportunity is not really to acknowledge any of the lessons we've learned over the last 100 years. And yet the ways that we engage in the world need to be updated for the modern moment. So how do we find ourselves at a place where we hold so few shared truths about American foreign policy? How do we get to a place where the American people really don't have much of a shared sense about what we think we deploy our troops for, what we think the purposes of the U.S. State Department purposes are, what the purposes of using the SWIFT system and U.S. Financial leadership through the Treasury Department and through Wall Street to be able to do things like apply sanctions that can lead other nations in a global financial sanctions regime. What are the purposes of defense, state, Treasury on the global stage? What are the purposes of the U.S. private sector when led by public-private partnerships? I think we should start in 1989. Because in 1989, The U.S. won the most fearful geopolitical contest in history. Truly, literally, the world could have come to an end through most of the decades between 1945 and 1989. And yet, three decades later, bizarrely, we seem to have won a war, but then lost a peace to an enemy that could have never defeated us on the battlefield. How can that happen? Too often, when we think about the role of the U.S. in the world today, we're presented with a false choice: retreat to a failed isolationism of the past, or assume that the U.S. can somehow be magical idealists who believe that every nation in the world will suddenly have our value system if only we send more troops there. That's a false choice. We cannot retreat from the global stage, and we cannot imagine that there's a magical opportunity for the U.S. to lead the world without some sense of the relationship between our values and our interests. Neither of these propositions are correct, and 30 years later, we still seem to be locked in not just a post-1989, but especially a post-9/11 construct. We are now twice as far from 9/11 as 9/11 was from 1989, and yet we seem to have less of a sense of what the challenges are before us now than we did on the eve of 9/11. The question before us today should be this: will we retreat in the face of a rising China and an expansionist Russia, or will we project American power in the world in a way that is actually a good deal for the American people and in line with our values so that we can ensure that we will have a second American century? Before we can figure that out, though, we need to map some of the challenges before us, and we need to ask the fair question many of our fellow citizens are asking. In a room like this, there are many people who've thought a lot about global security and about foreign policy objectives. But across 320 million Americans, a lot of people start with sort of an instinctual sense in their gut that the foreign policy establishment in both the Republican and Democratic parties doesn't really know what it's doing. And there are some fair reasons why our fellow citizens believe that. Look around the world. The American people rightly look at places where we're engaged, and they wonder if we're making a difference and if it's worth the cost. Consider. One, we've endured nearly two decades of war since 9/11, and we have no resolution in our engagement in the Middle East in sight. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has now grown so bold that not only do they repeatedly spurn attempts at peace, they attacked the head of the American forces in their country just this month. Lieutenant General Austin Miller was unharmed, but three other Americans with him were wounded and nearly killed. Number two, U.S. allies have increasingly chosen to free ride under our security umbrella instead of contributing meaningfully to our collective defense. American troops, as I mentioned, are now stationed at three-quarters of all the countries across the globe. American troops are sitting and sleeping tonight in 150 of the world's 200 nations, including many countries that have significant military resources and financial resources, and yet they choose to free ride on our security umbrella. What are we doing in these places? Nebraskans regularly ask me. Number three, the global financial system that America worked so hard to create and secure, it seems, in the eyes of many of our neighbors again, not to be working in our favor. It's been exploited regularly by cheating actors like China. Traditional lifelong jobs have been outsourced in large numbers, and many American workers today believe that the system, and especially the financial and trading system, is stacked against them. There are more things we could list. What on earth is going wrong, many of our fellow citizens ask, and what went wrong, they think? How was it that we won the Cold War, but seem to have lost the post-Cold War? Since the end of the Cold War, we have struggled to figure out the proper role of the U.S. in the world. The last three decades of American foreign policy have been marked by uncertainty, ambivalence, and incoherence. Different administrations play tug of war so that when you head into a campaign season, it isn't the case that we have a continuum of what America agrees on and then a small divergence between Republican and Democratic positions. What we really typically have is a challenger party that always attacks the incumbent party, and then when it becomes the new administration, adopts lots of the positions of the previous administration, and the party that used to be in power and is now out of power reverses its positions to criticize the status quo. The result has been a muddle of unclear and often conflicting policies with no shared vision across our populace about what America's role in the world should be. What becomes clear is chiefly that political leaders and full-time foreign policy experts in Washington, but also in the academy, have failed to adapt the lessons of Americans' extraordinary 20th century achievements and adapt them for our new moment to be sure we can bring the American people along with some shared vision for what we're up to. President Trump, to his credit, has intuited some of these big problems. He's been willing to call BS on the tendency of foreign policy experts to recycle old, tired ideas and pretend that old constructs necessarily fit the hard questions of a world today that looks quite different than it did in 1985. I'm pretty young in the US Senate, but I realize when you're back on a university campus as a 46-year-old, 1989 is a history book memory for many students. If you're a 20-year-old here today, if you're a sophomore or a junior and you're 20 years old, and if you're the firstborn for your mom, and among college crowds, your mom usually statistically had her first baby at age 27, it means your mom's 47. That means in 1984, 85, the last time we really had a big debate about what the US role in the world was, 4 or 5 years before we won the Cold War, it means your mom was 14 the last time we had this debate. We're more than two generations since we last had any shared understanding of the U.S. role in the world. And so, a whole lot of people have been asking for a while, are we stuck? Does our foreign policy have any grand vision that we can all buy into so that elections, we in the American system, we're supposed to have a gap between campaigning and governing. And campaigning is supposed to be the small thing. And then people take office and they serve as public servants for a short period of time, and there are consensus views about what we're doing. And then 3.5 or 3.75 years later, we're supposed to have a short campaign where the difference between the two, or arguably more than two, differentiated positions on the stage can be netted out. We fight about those differences for course correction, and a new set of people come in to govern, and we get back to a sense of what we, the American people, believe in common. We don't do that right now. Campaigns last all the time, and governing almost never happens. Unfortunately, while the president is right about many of these problems, that is, the need to revisit fundamental principles, he doesn't actually have any plan for what we should do next. In his case, the president's usual answer is to say some version of a guy in a bar saying we should retreat from the global stage, sold under the recycled banner of America First. The president's sloganeering foreign policy is actually quite similar to the main thrust of most of President Obama's foreign policy, which was summed up in the infamous phrase, leading from behind. What did that mean? Both President Trump's instinct that we should retreat from the global stage and President Obama's view that we should lead from behind really send a similar message that in most places around the globe, we should let other people fend for themselves for a while, and the US can lean back and let other people lead. I think history makes clear that that won't work. Unfortunately, while the president is right about many of these problems, that is, the need to revisit fundamental principles, he doesn't actually have any plan for what we should do next. Stumbling along from administration to administration and conflict to conflict, and really reactionary foreign policy to reactionary foreign policy, is not only unsustainable, it's dangerous. So, I think the time is right to think seriously about a new way forward, a way that protects the achievements of an American-made world order over the last 100 years, but especially the last 75 years, a policy that upholds our enduring values, and yet a policy that can be responsive to the new challenges of the digital age and the rise of China.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This half hour, we're listening to excerpts from a speech Nebraska Republican Senator Ben Sasse gave last night at the University of Iowa. He spoke about American involvement in conflict at home and abroad and how Americans have been affected by war and times of post-war, referencing the great prosperity Americans saw after the Second World War, but not after World War I or after the Cold War. He went on to talk about what steps the U.S. should be making right now to continue to be a responsible leader on the world stage.
So over the next handful of months, it is my hope that more of us in Washington will be wrestling with a number of specific policy proposals crucial to renewing our long-term shared U.S. leadership role in the world. Much of what we need, I believe, relates to a cyber strategy that would be unparalleled in the world, a cyber strategy and a cyber force, and alliances that make clear how the U.S. will stand up to those who will wage gray space and hybrid war against us, as Russia in a clunky way is now doing, and as China in a quite more sophisticated way will inevitably be doing over the course of the next decade and two to come. As a student of history, I recognize that drawing current foreign policy pragmatic lessons from the past is a tricky business, but I think the last century has taught at least four lessons that are indisputable. One, we know that we cannot avoid global problems by avoiding global responsibilities. The oceans that surround us are not nearly large enough to protect us from the world's problems. If Europe dissolves into conflict as Russia seeks to fracture NATO, or if war breaks out in Asia, it's going to find us. We cannot shut our eyes and pretend these problems can go away. The only solution is for us to prepare and to think clearly about what sort of alliances we should have. Number two, we know that alliances matter. Alliances between nations with similar values won the last three global wars we talked about, World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. All three were won by alliances that came together based on shared values to prevent nuclear catastrophe and are still the primary deterrent against Russian and Chinese aggression. We need to recognize that our alliance system is integral to the world that we've built over the last 75 years. Number three, we know that free trade is a tool of American power. American economic freedom is one of the most powerful forces the world has ever known. We've seen it on display in times of war when the economy has been able to turn on a dime and supply hundreds of thousands of soldiers setting out for the front lines. Command and control economies, which seemingly can shoot someone in the back, have never been able to produce what market-oriented systems have been able to produce in times of crisis, because with people with souls are led by beliefs and by creeds, not merely by the fear that comes from their totalitarian leaders standing behind them. We've also seen the power of the market and of U.S. global trading leadership come into play in the kinds of innovations that come from American entrepreneurs and from entrepreneurs across the globe who want to come to America. Economic freedom allows people to transform their lives, to secure the future for their children, and to love and serve their neighbors. Trade is how we expand freedom for ourselves and how we open it up to people in other places. When people are free to trade goods and services with one another, both sides of the equation gain, and new trading opportunities are created. Soon, more and more people are brought into those supply chains and into those broader liberty relationships that often begin with economics and descend to politics. But when we cut ourselves off from our neighbors, we cut ourselves off from those opportunities. We cut ourselves off from that commerce, not merely economic commerce, but people commerce. We hurt ourselves and our trading partners, and we lose the influence that our trade with them could have provided. And fourth, we know that we need a clearly shared vision of America's role in the world, clearly shared across America. Coastal and plain, Republican and Democrat, rich and middle class and poor, but also a clearly shared vision of Americans' role in the world with our allies so that they can know that they should trust us and our enemies outside those alliances should fear us and the thickness and the durability of those relationships. While we have managed to keep the peace most of the time since the end of the Cold War, we have struggled to articulate what our role is, and in the process, we have increasingly been emboldening our enemies. We have alienated our friends, we have sacrificed much of our influence, and we've increasingly confused our people. This is unsustainable. That sense that we feel that America, not just in the world, but America at home, doesn't know who we are, it's a real sense because we don't know who we are in a shared way at this time. We need political leadership on both sides that understands that there is no alternative to American leadership in the world and who commit to building it up for a new era. These are some of the indispensable lessons of the last 100 years in terms of knowledge, learning. But who are we in terms of what we believe? What should we affirm together? What do we proclaim together? For Americans believe strange and wonderful things. We believe in the dignity of every human being across 7.5 billion people across this globe, not just 320 million Americans. We believe in the dignity of humans. We believe that government properly exists only with the consent of the governed. We believe that government is limited because human beings have rights by nature and nature's God, and government is our shared project to secure those rights. Those that govern are not the author and source of our rights. They are servants trying to advance a framework to maintain ordered liberty. And we believe that those rights include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Our ideal foreign policy and I say the word ideal on purpose, but I'll qualify it in a minute, our ideal foreign policy should never contradict those convictions, those core affirmational beliefs about who we are as Americans. If we violate them in our dealings with people beyond our borders, inevitably, we will ultimately begin to violate them here at home. Our principles are not a liability. Our principles are a strategic asset. We tend to forget this. And some people, reflexively hostile to America, refuse to believe this. But across the rest of the world, America remains a beacon of liberty, a safeguard of human dignity. This is why imprisoned house church leaders in China look to America. This is why tortured North Korean dissidents look to America. This is why oppressed Iranian refugees look to America. This is why trafficked children from the Sudan look to America. This is why Jamal Khashoggi, who chose to make his home in the United States, they see us as their natural ally, as their champion, and as their hope. They see the United States as a place where people can breathe free. For all the problems we have, they are right. The United States is their natural champion, their natural beacon of hope. Similarly, the rest of the world still sees us, despite all of our problems, as the land of prosperity, opportunity, and innovation. They see America as a place where anyone with a good idea and enough elbow grease can make it. For all the problems we have, they are still right about this. No one goes to Russia for prosperity and opportunity. Dissidents don't flee to China in pursuit of liberty. Our friends and our opponents on the global stage know this, and we need to use this. A global order led by those countries is not going to be a global order very interested in human rights, in human freedom, or in human dignity. When America chooses to lead, prosperity and dignity inevitably follow. Not immediately, but inevitably. To see clearly what this leadership ought to look like, we need to bring together the exceptional things we believe in, which can serve our interests and help millions and millions of people across the globe who are fighting for a better, more humane life. And everything that we have learned for the past 100 years is that there need not be a deep and immediate conflict between our values and our interests. Too often we pretend that somehow our values are a liability, and if we pursue our interests, we will have to abandon our values. There are times when there is a short-term conflict between our values and our interests, but in the long term, there is great alignment. And our interests are in our values, and our values will, in the long term, always advance our interests. We have new work to do. We have new threats to respond to. But we should reject the stupid false choice that the U.S. can just proclaim leadership from Washington without bringing the American people along, or that we can retreat from the global stage. There are many constructive things that in the question and answer, hopefully you might lead us to talk about, but I hope that I will have exceeded if I persuade you today of just one thing, which is that isolationism cannot work, but the response to isolationism cannot be to not ask the questions Americans are asking about what are these institutions, what should they accomplish, and how can the American people come along as one nation that doesn't whiplash every election from one side to the other as Democrats and Republicans both embrace a kind of establishment elitist rhetoric that implies the people are with you when really the only people who are with you are people who are happy that you won the election. We need an American foreign policy view that is 10 and 25 years long, not election cycle to election cycle.
Excerpts from an address given yesterday evening in Iowa City by U.S. Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska. After a short break, the Republican senator answers questions about the Kavanaugh confirmation. Sasse is a member of the Judiciary Committee. I also ask him about the hyperpartisan climate and the wave of package bombs, among other issues. That's after a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, highlights from an event yesterday evening at the University of Iowa, featuring U.S. Senator Ben Sasse. Sasse is a Republican from Nebraska. He earned a doctorate in American history from Yale University and taught at the University of Texas. He also served as an assistant secretary in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In 2010, he was named president of Midland University in Fremont, Nebraska. Then in 2014, he successfully ran for a vacant seat in the U.S. Senate and defeated his Democratic Party opponent, by a margin of 65% to 31%. He lives in Fremont, Nebraska, with his wife, Melissa, and three children. All of his kids are homeschooled. Sass is the author of The Vanishing American Adult, that from 2017, and Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal, that from 2018. It's notable that in early 2016, Ben Sass announced that he would not support then-Republican frontrunner Donald Trump should Trump become the party's nominee. He was the first sitting senator to make such an announcement. Let's listen to the Q&A that I moderated with Senator Sass yesterday evening before an audience at the University of Iowa. I started by asking him, given the wave of package bombs in our news this week, if he thinks that Donald Trump bears any responsibility for creating a toxic environment, with the president's hostile remarks about opponents that have often referenced violence.
There is no place in America for a phrase like the press are the enemy of the people. In a First Amendment society like ours, we affirm the five principles, the five beating heart principles of the constitutional system, which are freedom of religion, press, speech, assembly, and protest, or the redress of grievances. It is well within the right of all 320 million Americans, and that certainly includes whoever occupies the White House at any given moment, to argue about particular press stories, to argue about bias, to argue about a lack of representative contextualization of a given story. But arguing about one story, or arguing about one reporter, or arguing about one media outlet is a completely different thing than classifying the press as the enemy of the American people. So that's very unhelpful rhetoric, and all 320 million Americans should join together in condemning political violence. We don't do domestic terrorism in the U.S. When people disagree in the United States, we try to win those battles by persuasion, not by violence.
Am I interpreting you correctly? So he does bear some responsibility in creating a hostile environment?
The phrase, the press is the enemy of the American people, is not a phrase any American should be uttering.
This is a Facebook question landed on my Facebook page after I mentioned that I would be here tonight doing some Q&A with you. Michael on Facebook asked, why do you speak the ethics of conscience, often criticizing the administration, and then follow the leader when voting on key issues, such as you did with Kavanaugh's confirmation?
So I've been a conservative for long before Donald Trump ever embraced any conservative positions, and I'll be a conservative long after Donald Trump has left the White House. And so right now I think it's important to distinguish between legislative fights and civics fights. And in legislation, I'm happy that the president has adopted positions that I've long held on a broad range of issues. But most of the really big things that are happening in America right now are not happening inside the Congress and are not things that we vote upon. So I think it's really important that when I, as a newbie to political life, I ran for office of kids that are 17, 14, and 7. They were 12, 10, and 2 when we lived on a campaign bus for 16 months. And I told Nebraskans across 93 counties what my views were on various issues. When we vote on things like regulatory reform, things that I believe in, it would be pretty bizarre for me to flip on the positions that I hold and that I told Nebraskans I hold and that I think are good for America because Donald Trump has come to embrace positions that I've long held. So I think it's really important to distinguish between legislative fights and broader civic fights. And one of the big problems we have right now in America is we're not attending to what we believe in common for 10 and 25 years from now for our kids. Those are the biggest issues. They're far bigger than our legislation.
What do you think of the New York Times report from a few days ago that the Trump administration is thinking about more narrowly defining gender in a binary way, not including transgender?
So I have not looked at the issue closely, but my understanding is that the administration's proposal is to return to a position that the U.S. had until the middle of the last year of the Obama administration. So again, I haven't read any of the regulatory language, so I don't know all the particulars of the fight. But I do think one of the downsides of the way we currently consume news is we assume that everything should be filtered through a tribal proxy of who in Washington might have been for it or against it at any given moment. And then we're all of a sudden all certain of our positions. I think the administration is proposing something that is the exact same position that the Obama administration had for the first 7.5 of their 8 years.
Do you personally believe in a spectrum of gender rather than a binary view of it, that there is a spectrum from male to female in gender identity?
So I think we need to define some terms. Historically, we've distinguished between sex and gender, and sex is a biological, science-based term that's about the ability to procreate, and gender has usually been viewed as a more societally defined question about what kinds of roles we play in life. And so if we uncouple sex and gender, it seems to me that there's a whole bunch of debates people have about gender that are about societal constructs of what roles we play. Sex, it appears that there are two kinds of sexes that get together and produce offspring. And so right now I think we have lots of situations where we want to have culture war screaming about every fight and we swallow up almost everything else. I don't think it's all that useful.
Question from our audience for Senator Sass. With the current division between political parties, what are the prospects of unifying the country long term? How do you see that happening, and how do you have, and do you have any examples?
Unity looks hard to come by right now, but one of the reasons why I was grateful for this invitation to come here and speak about foreign policy and U.S. security leadership in the world is that this shouldn't be something that starts by dividing us. It will inevitably divide farmers and manufacturers a little bit, right? If we unpacked a lot more of what we had talked about in trade, when there's more trade in the world, I'll get back to other unity issues, but I wanted to say one here that doesn't have to be Democrat versus Republican, right versus left. When there's more trade in the world, consumers on every side of a trading relationship win, and producers in both countries win on net, but producers in every sector don't win the same way. So when you have a trading debate, it is the case that industrial manufacturing industries regularly will have some losses in some parts of the country, and farmers are almost simply winners when there's more trade. And so Iowa and Nebraska are going to be more united, and Ohio and West Virginia are likely going to be in a slightly different place on trade. But what we do wrong now, I think, is that we're pretending that the tribes that are Republicans and Democrats are meaningful tribes of constructive affinity. We're pretending that Republicans and Democrats have so much in common that you can know that if you're a Republican, you have to be against everything Democrat, and if you're Democrat, you're supposed to be against everything Republican. I believe that we're living through a digital revolution, and that the majority of what we're experiencing right now in our dysfunctional politics is actually well downstream from more important cultural and economic matters. Politics are important. Again, I have 3 little kids, and I miss family dinner many nights every week because I fly away from them. I obviously think politics matter. But I think many of us are acting like politics is the center of life. I think that isn't true, and I think it can't succeed. I think political tribalism is amping in our time precisely because the normal tribes, the natural tribes, the traditional tribes are in collapse. I think the tension of our moment is a tension between rootlessness and rootedness. Almost all the happiness literature shows us that the things that make you happy are about place. Do you have a thick nuclear family? Do you have a couple of deep friendships that endure over time and place? Do you have meaningful work? Do you have shared vocation? Do you have coworkers? And do you have a theological or philosophical framework to make sense of death and suffering? Often expressed in, do you have a local worshiping community? Family, friends, work, and religion. These 4 things drive most of happiness, and all 4 of them are being undermined by a digital revolution where our iPhone tempts us to not be the place you're at, but to always yearn to be somewhere else. When traditional tribes collapse, we've had one data point, and I'll pull back and give it back to you, but we've had a halving of friendship in America in the last 27 years. The average American in 1990 had 3.2 friends. The average American today has 1.8. 43% of our neighbors have either no confidants at all or only one. That's weird. And what happens increasingly is we're allowing politics to fill the vacuum of the collapse of thick, embodied local tribes. And when that happens, we act like politics might have a solution. I don't think we're going to fix our politics by more politics. I think there will be unity that'll come again, but I think most of it is going to come in one of 2 ways, both of which, one is sort of dangerous and one is long-term. The dangerous one is this. If you have a global crisis, it's going to drive Americans back together. But man, that's a costly way to find unity. The more likely and the less calamitous way to find unity is going to be we figure out what habits of rootedness and community look like again in a digital age that's undermined place. And then politics can start to do the subset of things politics should do. Right now, our politics are trying to help you find the line between good and evil based on which tribe you're in. These people that I work with, we're not that interesting.
Mm-hmm. This questioner asks, even though you wrote this book about political tribalism, you recently voted to confirm Justice Kavanaugh. This audience member says, given the topic of your book you wrote, why would you vote to confirm a justice that displayed total partisanship?
Fair question. Obviously, our political confirmation process around Supreme Court justices is in collapse. The Senate Judiciary Committee, on which I serve, doesn't work. We're 32 years now since the Bork hearings of 1987. We're 32 years into a decline of every confirmation process seems uglier and bloodier, more ad hominem, and more televised. This doesn't work. The original Kavanaugh speech on his first day of the 4 days of hearings we did, I forget what we did, 38 hours of public hearings in the first round before we came back after the allegations. The first speech that he made was about the fact that in the Supreme Court, you don't have a central aisle. You don't have caucus rooms. My language, this wasn't his, but you don't have red and blue jerseys. You have a black robe by which individuals who serve on the court, from Elena Kagan, senior Obama administration official, to Kavanaugh, who'd been a senior official in the George W. Bush White House, once they go on the court, they're supposed to lay down their policy preferences. That's why you put on a black robe. That's what you're doing. You're shrouding yourself. That rhetoric and that speech was right. Subsequently, when we had a process that became terribly politicized, and I know we have limited time and you've got another question you want to ask, so I won't go into all of this, but there's a lot of blame we could lay at both Republicans and Democrats.
He blamed the Democrats, and he spun out a conspiracy theory against the Democrats. How are the Americans supposed to have confidence in a justice who has displayed such partisanship? So, I think that's behind the question.
Yeah, so there are two important things to say, and the right answers would take a half an hour, so I'll say them too briefly, but know that they need more qualification. Number one is there were particular Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee who made an active choice not to use the confidential process we have for allegations that has been used for decades, and they held allegations until after all of our classified sessions were over, allegations that they had in their hands for months. They held them and waited to roll them out in a media strategy once it was too late to do it confidentially. I was one of the Republicans who said we need to pause the vote. We need to have a now seventh FBI investigation. There were ultimately 146 people interviewed in that process. I spent around 150 hours reading the evidence that came in through that seventh FBI investigation. And he went off on particular Democrats on that committee, and he used broad language, of which he repented in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. The whole process is ugly, but I think it is, and it's not a good thing for people to be writing op-eds in a confirmation process for what should be an apolitical job, but I think it's worth going back and reading Kavanaugh's op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, where he essentially said that speech was a failure.
Senator Sass, I know you have to be off. I have two questions. They're quick. I don't know how long your answers will be. You will decide that. This questioner asks, how do we protect our election security as we move forward in the sake of defending our democracy?
Lots to say here, too. I'll just say two brief points. Number one, secretaries of state across 50 states and the District of Columbia have been and need to be doing a lot of work. They need to also call on the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have gotten a lot better at detecting potential vulnerabilities in the system, and there are more partnerships happening, so there's improvement. It's not good enough, but there's improvement. We should have redundancy in the system with pen and paper. Most cyber experts believe anything that's a one-time, moment-in-time event, you shouldn't rely on digital alone. We should have a backup system that is old atoms, not merely modern bits. But in addition, one of the most important things we can do to guard our election security and our national unity going forward is recognize the threat of information ops and gray-space propaganda war that we face. Russia today and China in the future are planning to wage battles, and Russia is today waging a battle that picks at every divide we have in America. Race, gender, geography, guns, abortion, there isn't news media, there isn't a cultural flashpoint conflict we have that Russia isn't trying to play on both sides of.
the national anthem controversy or the kneeling controversy in the NFL, when the president went to that unhelpfully in his rally in Alabama, whenever that was, 13 months ago, in the next 72 hours, Russia flooded into the U.S., and the two fastest trending hashtags in social media were stand for the anthem and take a knee, NFL. Both of them were majority Russia. We have to be more aware of how our internal divisions are a national security weakness, and Russia today in a clunky way, but China in ways that are going to be much more dangerous with deep fakes and fake audio and video in the future plan to exploit our weaknesses. The number one way we can build unity in the future is be aware of how much our current divisions weaken us.
Lastly, before you hit the road, questioner wants to know, where do you get your information from? Who do you trust for your information?
Great question. So two thoughts. Number one, on like the last point I just made, I was obviously not divulging any classified information. This has been released. But I spend between 25 and 40% of my time on cyber and intelligence issues. The U.S. intelligence community is a community that you should trust. There's lots of really great patriots in there. 17 bureaucratic agencies are clunky. We should have five or six. There's a lot wrong with our IC, but we should have an intelligence community that the American people know is worthy of you sending your 18 and 22 and 25-year-olds off to work for, because there's a lot we should trust there. The problem is their job isn't to do public information campaigns. So I think the second thing we need to recognize is where we live in the history of media ecology. We live at a time where the barriers to entry to new media are incredibly cheap, and so there are structural incentives for clickbait screaming about almost every issue. In the 1950s, there were only three media channels in America in the 1950s. I Love Lucy had a 68% share. It wasn't important content, but it was shared content. It meant everybody in America, probably 95% of all Americans any given week, knew what Lucy and Desi were doing. Why did that matter? Because it meant when you have a conflict with a coworker at the office, it means when you're disagreeing with a neighbor about politics, you still had something you could go back to as neighbors because you knew Lucy and Desi in common and there were ways to de-escalate. We don't have any shared cultural data right now. In the last 18 years, the most watched serial programming in America is Sunday Night Football for 3 weeks in 2014, got up to a 14% share. Right now, the most watched cable news programming in America, Sean Hannity is number one, Rachel Maddow is number two, 3.2 million Americans, 2.9 million Americans, 1% of the public, and 0.9% of the public. 93% of American households have access to 500 or more media channels. What does that mean? It means inevitably that if you're trying to intensify your 1% audience, instead of even pretend that you have a chance to reach to a 55 or a 75% audience, you can always just demonize somebody on the other side of an issue because you don't ever conceive of them as a part of your shared conversation anyway. We need lots more shared conversations that bridge much wider across the political spectrum, but also consider and consult lots of issues that aren't just politics. I will also say, at risk of sounding like I'm being too deferential to our questioner, I do think more print-based and audio-based content is a lot more useful than instant visual content. Visual content is usually driven by something that's not logo-centric, that's not idea-centric. It's trying to inflame our passions. One of the reasons the Senate doesn't work, one of the reasons the Senate is not the greatest deliberative body in the world, despite our brand name, is because the Senate has decided to fill every space in our building with cameras. Every committee hearing is really about senators trying to serial grandstand and posture for cameras, and we need more audio-based content, we need more print content. So as a sign-off point to say something positive, the rise of podcasting is actually great for America. 65 million Americans downloading long-form substantive podcast content every week, that's a lot better than a lot of our cable news screaming. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Republican Senator from Nebraska, Ben Sasse, that in an appearance yesterday evening in Iowa City. Hey, I want to extend our thanks to the University of Iowa Lecture Committee for making us part of that event. Just time enough left in the hour to groove into the weekend with Tony Daner, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Hey there, Tony.
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
pretty good. What do you got for us?
This time around, we're going to check out a new song from Kurt Vile, singer-songwriter who's put out a bunch of solo records and did a great record with Courtney Barnett just last year. Known for his unique guitar sound and pretty unique vocal style, kind of relaxed, kind of chill. This new record is called Bottle It In, and this is the first song on the album. There's also a cool music video for this song. It's called Loading Zones. Kurt Vile.
I want to be like I am the mayor of some godforsaken town. Sure, they knighted me yesterday, but who needs armor when I've an exoskeleton? I slip and squirm through the cracks, creep around by the all the loading zones in my dirty little town. Get my shopping done.
I love that. The vocals by Kurt Vile there, Loading Zones. Tony, just enough time to tell us how people can listen to Studio One tracks, Studio One all over the weekend, and other programs you have.
Yeah, Studio One tracks 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock. You can also catch it at 7 o'clock the following morning on our 24-hour Studio One stream. That's on the app or at our website. And great music programming all weekend long, too.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Ben.
We'll end it there with Kurt Vile. Tony Daner, thanks again. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Girls and a dying daddy, but oh so gorgeous the way they pray. How beautiful to take a bite out of the world. I want to rip the world a new one. It just crawls out of my mouth anymore. You can hate on it, or you can hug it. You can get all mushy and lovey-dovey. It's all the same when I'm out there driving around, all from zone to loading zone of my beautiful town. Ah.